terrible charges, and the realm must know the truth of them. If your grace has told it true, no doubt a trial will prove your innocence.
A trial still? I have confessed.
To certain sins aye, others you deny. Your trial will separate the truths from the falsehoods. I shall ask the seven to forgive the sins you have confessed, and pray that you will be found innocent of these other accusations.
Circe rose slowly from her knees. I bow to the wisdom of your high holiness, she said. But if I might beg for just one drop of the mother's mercy, it has been so long since I last saw my son. Please. The old man's eyes were chips of flint.
It would not be fitting to allow you near the king until you have been cleansed of all your wickedness. You have taken the first step on your path back to righteousness. However, and in the light of that, I shall permit you other visitors, one each day.
The queen began to weep again. This time the tears were true. You are too kind. Thank you.
The mother is merciful. It is her you should thank.
Moel and Scalera were waiting to lead her back up to her tower cell. Eunella followed close behind them.
We have all been praying for your grace, Scepter Moel said as they were climbing. Yes, Scepter Scalera echoed, and you must feel so much lighter now, clean and innocent as a maid on the morning of her wedding.
I fucked Jamie on the morning of my wedding, the queen recalled. I do, she said. I feel reborn, as if a festering boil has been lanced, and now at last I can begin to heal. I could almost fly. She imagined how sweet it would be to slam an elbow into Scepter Scalera's face and send her careening down the spiral steps. If the guards were good, the wrinkled old cunt might crash into Scepter Eunella and take her down with her.
It is good to see you smiling again, Scalera said. His High Holiness said I might have visitors.
He did, said Scepter Eunella. If your grace will tell us whom you wish to see, we will send word to them.
Jamie, I need Jamie. But if her twin was in the city, why did he not come to her? It might be wiser to wait on Jamie until she had a better notion of what was happening beyond the walls of the great Scepter Baelor. My uncle, she said, Sir Kevin Lannister, my father's brother, is he in the city?
He is, said Scepter Eunella. The Lord Regent has taken up residence in the Red Keep. We will send for him at once.
Thank you, said Circe, thinking, Lord Regent, is it?
She could not pretend to be surprised. A humble and a contrite heart proved to have benefits over and beyond cleansing the soul of sin. That night the queen was moved to a larger cell 2 floors down, with a window she could actually look out of, and warm, soft blankets for her bed. And when time came for supper, instead of stale bread and oaten porridge, she was served a rose capon, a bowl of crisp greens sprinkled with crushed walnuts, and a mound of mashed neeps aswim in butter. That night she crawled into her bed with a full stomach for the first time since she was taken, and slept through the black watches of the night undisturbed. The next morning, with the dawn, there came her uncle. Circe was still at her breakfast when the door swung open, and Sir Kevin Lannister stepped through. "Leave us," he told her jailers. Scepter Moel ushered Scalera and Eunella away and closed the door behind them. The queen rose to her feet. Sir Kevin looked older than when she had seen him last. He was a big man, broad in the shoulder and thick about the waist, with a close-cropped blonde beard that followed the line of his heavy jaw and short blonde hair in full retreat from his brow. A heavy woolen cloak dyed crimson, was clasped at one shoulder with a golden brooch in the shape of a lion's head.
"I thank you for coming," the queen said.
Her uncle frowned. "You should sit. There are things that I must needs tell you." She did not want to sit.
"You are still angry with me. I hear it in your voice. Forgive me, uncle. It was wrong of me to throw my wine at you, but—"
"You think I care about a cup of wine? Lancel is my son, Cersei, your own nephew. If I am angry with you, that is the cause. You should have looked after him, guided him, found him a likely girl of good family. Instead, you—"
"I know, I know.
Lancel wanted me more than I ever wanted him. He still does, I will wager.
I was alone, weak. Please, uncle, oh, uncle, it is so good to see your face. Your sweet, sweet face. I have done wicked things, I know. But I could not bear for you to hit me." She threw her arms around him, kissed his cheeks. "Forgive me, forgive me."
Sir Kevin suffered the embrace for a few heartbeats before he finally raised his own arms to return it. His hug was short and awkward. "Enough," he said, his voice still flat and cold. "You are forgiven. Now sit. I bring some hard tidings, Cersei." His words frightened her. "Has something happened to Tommen? Oh, please, no. I have been so afraid for my son. No one will tell me anything. Please tell me that Tommen is well."
"His Grace is well. He asks about you often."
Sir Kevin laid his hands on her shoulders. He held her at arm's length.
"Jaime, then. Is it Jaime?"
"No, Jaime is still in the Riverland somewhere."
"Somewhere?" She did not like the sound of that.
"He took Raventree and accepted Lord Blackwood's surrender," said her uncle. "But on his way back to Riverrun, he left his tail and went off with a woman."
"A woman?" Cersei stared at him, uncomprehending.
"What woman? Why? Where did they go?"
"No one knows. We've had no further word of him. The woman may have been the Evanstar's daughter, Lady Brienne."
"Her?" The queen remembered the Maid of Tarth, a huge, ugly, shambling thing who dressed in man's mail.
"Jaime would never abandon me for such a creature. My raven never reached him. Elsewise, he would have come."
"We've had reports of sellswords landing all over the south," Sir Kevin was saying. "Tarth, the Stepstones, Cape Wrath. Where Stannis found the coin to hire a free company, I would dearly love to know. I do not have the strength to deal with them, not here. Mace Tyrell does, but he refuses to bestir himself until this matter with his daughter has been settled."
"A headsman would settle Marjorie quick enough."
Cersei did not care a fig for Stannis or his sellswords. "The others take him, and the Tyrells both. Let them slaughter each other. The realm will be the better for it. Please, uncle, take me out of here."
"How? By force of arms?"
Sir Kevin walked to the window and gazed out frowning.
"I would need to make an abattoir of this holy place, and I do not have the men. The best part of our forces was at Riverrun with your brother. I had no time to raise a new host."
He turned back to face her.
"I have spoken with His High Holiness. He will not release you until you have atoned for your sins."
"I have confessed."
"Atoned," I said. "Before the city. A walk."
"No."
She knew what her uncle was about to say, and she did not want to hear it.
"Never. Tell him that if you speak to him again. I am a queen, not some duckside whore."
"No harm would come to you. No one would touch—"
"No," she said more sharply. "I would sooner die."
Sir Kevin was unmoved.
"If that is your wish, you may soon have it granted. His High Holiness is resolved that you be tried for regicide, deicide, incest, and high treason."
"Deicide?"
She almost laughed.
"When did I kill a god?"
"The High Septon speaks for the seven here on earth. Strike at him, and you're striking at the gods themselves."
Her uncle raised a hand before she could protest.
"It does no good to speak of such things. Not here.
The time for all that is that trial. He gazed about her cell. The look on his face spoke volumes. Someone is listening. Even here, even now, she dare not speak freely. She took a breath. Who will try me? The faith, her uncle said, unless you insist on a trial by battle, in which case you must be championed by a knight of the king's guard. Whatever the outcome, your rule is at an end. I will serve as Tommen's regent until he comes of age. Mace Tyrell has been named King's Hand. Grand Maester Pycelle and Sir Harris Swift will continue as before, but Paxter Redwine is now Lord Admiral, and Randolph Tarley has assumed the duties of Justiciar. Tyrell Bannerman, the both of them. The whole governance of the realm was being handed to her enemies, Queen Marjorie's kith and kin. Marjorie stands accused as well. Her and those cousins of hers, how is it that the Sparrows freed her and not me? Randall Tarley insisted. He was the first to reach King's Landing when this storm broke, and he brought his army with him. The Tyrell girls will still be tried, but the case against them is weak. His High Holiness admits. All of the men named as the Queen's lovers have denied the accusation or recanted, save for your Mame Singer, who appears to be half mad. So the High Septon handed the girls over to Tarley's custody, and Lord Randall swore a holy oath to deliver them for trial when the time comes. And her accusers? The Queen demanded. Who holds them? Osney Kettleblack and the Blue Bard are here, beneath the sept. The Redwine twins have been declared innocent, and Hamish the Harper has died. The rest are in the dungeons under the Red Keep, in the charge of your man, Qyburn. Qyburn, thought Cersei. That was good. One straw at least that she could clutch. Lord Qyburn had them, and Lord Qyburn could do wonders. And horrors. He can do horrors as well. There is more. Worse. Will you sit down? Sit down? Cersei shook her head. What could be worse? She was to be tried for high treason, whilst the little queen and her cousins flew off as free as birds. Tell me, what is it? Miss Heller, we have had grave news from Dorne. Tyrion, she said at once. Tyrion had sent her little girl to Dorne, and Cersei had dispatched Sir Balin Swan to bring her home. All Dornishmen were snakes, and the Martells were the worst of them. The Red Viper had even tried to defend the imp, had come within a hair's breadth of a victory that would have allowed the dwarf to escape the blame for Joffrey's murder. It's him. He's been in Dorne all this time, and now he sees my daughter. Sir Kevin gave her another scowl. Marcella was attacked by a Dornish knight named Gerald Dane. She's alive, but hurt. He slashed her face open, and she... I'm sorry. She lost an ear. An ear? Cersei stared at him aghast. She was just a child, my precious princess. She was so pretty, too. He cut off her ear? And Prince Doran and his Dornish knights, where were they? They could not defend one little girl. Where was Ares Okart? Slain, defending her. Dane cut him down, it said. The Sword of the Morning had been a Dane, the Queen recalled, but he was long dead. Who was this Sir Gerald, and why would he wish to harm her daughter? She could not make any sense of this, unless... Tyrion lost half his nose in the Battle of the Blackwater, slashing her face, cutting off an ear. The imp's grubby little fingers are all over this. Prince Doran says nothing of your brother, and Balon Swan writes of this Marcella, puts it all on this Gerald Dane. Darkstar, they call him. She gave a bitter laugh. Whatever they call him, he is my brother's catspaw. Tyrion has friends amongst the Dornish. The imp planned this all along. It was Tyrion who betrothed Mycela to Prince Trysane. Now I see why. You see Tyrion in every shadow. He is a creature of the shadows. He killed Joffrey. He killed father. Did you think he would stop there? I feared that the imp was still in King's Landing, plotting harm to Tommen. But he must have gone to Dorne instead, to kill Mycela first. Cersei paced the width of the cell. I need to be with Tommen. These Kingsguard's knights are as useless as nipples on a breastplate. She rounded on her uncle. Sir Aerys was killed, you said? At the hands of this man Darkstar, yes. Dead. He's dead. Are you certain of that? That is what we have been told. Then there is an empty place amongst the King's Guard. It must be filled at once. Tommen must be protected. Lord Tarly is drawing up a list of worthy knights for your brother to consider. But until Jaime reappears... The king can give a man a white cloak. Tommen's a good boy. Tell him whom to name, and he will name him. And whom would you have him name? She did not have a ready answer. My champion will need a new name, as well as a new face. Qyburn will know. Trust him in this. You and I have had our differences, uncle, but for the blood we share, and the love you bore my father, for Tommen's sake and the sake of his poor maimed sister, do as I ask you. Go to Lord Qyburn, on my behalf. Bring him a white cloak, and tell him that the time has come.
Daenerys. When he had taken his pleasure, Khal Drogo rose from their sleeping mats to tower above her. His skin shone dark as bronze in the ruddy light from the brazier, the faint lines of old scars visible on his broad chest. Ink-black hair, loose and unbound, cascaded over his shoulders and down his back, well past his waist. His manhood glistened wetly. The Khal's mouth twisted in a frown beneath the droop of his long mustachio.
"The stallion who mounts the world has no need of iron chairs."
Danny propped herself on an elbow to look up at him, so tall and magnificent. She loved his hair especially. It had never been cut. He had never known defeat. It was prophesied that the stallion will ride to the ends of the earth, she said.
"The earth ends at the Black Salt Sea," Drogo answered at once.
He wet a cloth in a basin of warm water to wipe the sweat and oil from his skin.
"No horse can cross the poisoned water."
"In the free cities there are ships by the thousand," Danny told him, as she had told him before, "wooden horses with 100 legs that fly across the sea on wings full of wind." Khal Drogo did not want to hear it.
"We will speak no more of wooden horses and iron chairs."
He dropped the cloth and began to dress.
"This day I will go to the grass and hunt woman-wife," he announced, as he shrugged into a painted vest and buckled on a wide belt with heavy medallions of silver, gold, and bronze.
"Yes, my sun and stars," Danny said. "Drogo would take his blood riders and ride in search of Racha, the great white lion of the plains. If they returned triumphant, her lord husband's joy would be fierce, and he might be willing to hear her out. Savage beasts he did not fear, nor any man who had ever drawn breath, but the sea was a different matter. To the Dothraki, water that a horse could not drink was something foul. The heaving grey-green plains of the ocean filled them with superstitious loathing. Drogo was a bolder man than the other horse lords in half a hundred ways she had found, but not in this. If only she could get him onto a ship. After the Khal and his blood riders had ridden off with their bows, Danny summoned her handmaids. Her body felt so fat and ungainly now that she welcomed the help of their strong arms and deft hands, whereas before she had often been uncomfortable with the way they fussed and fluttered about her. They scrubbed her clean, and dressed her in sand silk, loose and flowing. As Doria combed out her hair, she sent Jiqui to find Sir Jorah Mormont. The knight came at once. He wore horsehair leggings and painted vest like a rider. Coarse black hair covered his thick chest and muscular arms.
"My princess, how can I serve you?"
"You must talk to my lord husband," Danny said. "Drogo says the stallion who mounts the world will have all the lands of the earth to rule and no need to cross the poison water. He talks of leading his Khalasar east, after Rhaego is born, to plunder the lands around the Jade Sea." The knight looked thoughtful.
"The Carl has never seen the Seven Kingdoms," he said. "They're nothing to him. If he thinks of them at all, no doubt he thinks of islands, a few small cities clinging to rocks in the manner of Lorath and Lice, surrounded by stormy seas. The riches of the East must seem a far more tempting prospect."
"But he must ride west," Danny said, despairing. "Please help me to make him understand." She had never seen the Seven Seas either, no more than Drogo. Yet she felt as though she knew them from all the tales her brother had told her. Viserys had promised her 1,000 times that he would take her back one day. But he was dead now, and his promises had died with him.
"The Dothraki do things in their own time, for their own reasons," the knight said. "Have patience, princess. Do not make your brother's mistake. We will go home, I promise you."
Home. The word made her feel sad. Sir Jorah had his bare island, but what was home to her? A few tales, names recited as solemnly as the words of a prayer, the fading memory of a red door. Was Vaes Dothrak to be her home forever? When she looked at the crones of the Dush Kaleen, was she looking at her future? Sir Jorah must have seen the sadness on her face.
"A great caravan arrived during the night, Khaleesi. 400 horses from Pentos by way of Norvas and Cahor, under the command of merchant captain Bayan Vatayus. Illyrio may have sent a letter. Would you care to visit the Western Market?"
Danny stirred. "Yes," she said, "I would like that." The markets came alive when a caravan had come in. You could never tell what treasures the traders might bring this time, and it would be good to hear men speaking Valyrian again, as they did in the free cities. "Iri, have them prepare a litter."
"I shall tell your cause," Sir Jorah said, withdrawing.
If Khal Drogo had been with her, Danny would have ridden her silver. Among the Dothraki, Mother stayed on horseback almost up to the moment of birth, and she did not want to seem weak in her husband's eyes, but with a Carl off hunting, it was a pleasure to lie back on soft cushions and be carried across Vaes Dothrak, with red silk curtains to shield her from the sun. Sir Jorah saddled up and rode beside her, with the four young men of her cars and her handmaids. The day was warm and cloudless, the sky a deep blue. When the wind blew, she could smell the rich scents of grass and earth. As her litter passed beneath the stolen monuments, she went from sunlight to shadow and back again. Danny swayed along, studying the faces of dead heroes and forgotten kings. She wondered if the gods of burned cities could still answer prayers. "If I were not the blood of the dragon," she thought wistfully, "this could be my home." She was Khaleesi. She had a strong man and a swift horse, handmaids to serve her, warriors to keep her safe, an honored place in the Dush Kaleen awaiting her when she grew old, and in her womb grew a son who would one day bestride the world. That should be enough for any woman. But not for the dragon. With Viserys gone, Daenerys was the last, the very last. She was the seed of kings and conquerors, and so too the child inside her. She must not forget. the Western Market was a great square of beaten earth, surrounded by warrens of mud-baked brick, animal pens, whitewashed drinking halls. Hummocks rose from the ground like the backs of great subterranean beasts breaking the surface, yawning black mouths leading down to cool and cavernous storerooms below. The interior of the square was a maze of stalls and crook-back aisles, shaded by awnings of woven grass. 100 merchants and traders were unloading their goods and setting up in stalls when they arrived. Yet even so, the great market seemed hushed and deserted compared to the teeming bazaars that Danny remembered from Pentos and the other free cities. The caravans made their way to Vaiz Dothrak from east and west, not so much to sell to the Dothraki as to trade with each other, Ser Jorah had explained. The riders let them come and go unmolested, so long as they observed the peace of the sacred city, did not profane the mother of mountains or the womb of the world, and honored the crones of the Doshkaleen with the traditional gifts of salt, silver, and seed. The Dothraki did not truly comprehend this business of buying and selling. Danny liked the strangeness of the Eastern Market, too, with all its queer sights and sounds and smells. She often spent her mornings there, nibbling tree eggs, locust pie, and green noodles, listening to the high, ululating voices of the spell singers, gaping at manticores in silver cages, and immense grey elephants, and the striped black-and-white horses of the Jogus Nai. She enjoyed watching all the people, too. Dark, solemn Ashai, and tall, pale Kathin, the bright-eyed men of Yiti in monkey-tail hats, warrior maids from Bayashabad, Shamiriana, and Kaya Kaya Naya, with iron rings in their nipples and rubies in their cheeks, even the dour and frightening shadow men who covered their arms and legs and chests with tattoos and hid their faces behind masks. The Eastern Market was a place of wonder and magic for Danny. But the Western Market smelled of home. As Iri and Jiqui helped her from her litter, she sniffed and recognized the sharp odors of garlic and pepper, scents that reminded Danny of days long gone in the alleys of Tyrush and Myrrh, and brought a fun smile to her face. Under that she smelled the heady, sweet perfumes of lice. She saw slaves carrying bolts of intricate Myrrhish lace and fine wools in a dozen rich colours. Caravan guards wandered among the aisles in copper helmets and knee-length tunics of quilted yellow cotton, empty scabbards swinging from their woven leather belts. Behind one stall, an armourer displayed steel breastplates, worked with gold and silver in ornate patterns, and helms hammered in the shapes of fanciful beasts. Next to him was a pretty young woman selling Lannisport goldwork, rings and brooches and torques and exquisitely wrought medallions suitable for belting. A huge eunuch guarded her stall, mute and hairless, dressed in sweat-stained velvets and scowling at anyone who came close. Across the aisle, a fat cloth trader from Yi Ti was haggling with a Pentoshi over the price of some green dye, the monkey tail of his hat swaying back and forth as he shook his head. "When I was a little girl, I loved to play in the bazaar," Danny told Ser Jorah, as they wandered down the shady aisle between the stalls. "It was so alive there, all the people shouting and laughing, so many wonderful things to look at, though we seldom had enough coin to buy anything. Well, except for a sausage now and again, or honey fingers. Do they have honey fingers in the Seven Kingdoms, the kind they bake in Tyrosh?"
"Cakes, are they? I could not say, Princess," the knight bowed. "If you would pardon me for a time, I will seek out the captain and see if he has letters for us."
"Very well, I'll help you find him."
There's no need to trouble yourself." Ser Jorah glanced away impatiently. "Enjoy the market.
I will rejoin you when my business is concluded. Curious, Danny thought, as she watched him stride off through the throngs. She didn't see why she should not go with him. Perhaps Ajora meant to find a woman after she had met with a merchant captain. Whores frequently travelled with the caravans, she knew, and some men were queerly shy about their couplings. She gave a shrug. Come, she told the others. Her handmaids trailed along as Danny resumed her stroll through the market.
Oh, look, she exclaimed to Doria. Those are the kind of sausages I meant.
She pointed to a stall where a wizened little woman was grilling meat and onions on a hot firestone. They make them with lots of garlic and hot peppers. Delighted with her discovery, Danny insisted the others join her for a sausage. Her handmaids woofed theirs down, giggling and grinning, though the men of her cars sniffed at the grilled meat suspiciously. They taste different than I remember, Danny said after her first few bites.
In Pentos, I make them with pork, the old lady said. But all my pigs died in the Dasvarkisi. These are made of horse meat, Kalishi, but I spice them the same.
Oh, Danny felt disappointed. But Quaro liked his sausage so well he decided to have another one, and Ricardo had to outdo him and eat three more, belching loudly. Danny giggled. You have not laughed since your brother, the Khal Regat, was crowned by Drogo, said Iri. It is good to see, Khaleesi. Danny smiled shyly. It was sweet to laugh. She felt half a girl again. They wandered for half the morning. She saw a beautiful feathered cloak from the Summer Isles and took it for a gift. In return, she gave the merchant a silver medallion from her belt. That was how it was done among the Dothraki. A bird seller taught a green and red parrot to say her name, and Danny laughed again, yet still refused to take him. What would she do with a green and red parrot in a Kalasar? She did take a dozen flasks of scented oils, the perfumes of her childhood. She had only to close her eyes and sniff them, and she could see the big house with the red door once more. When Doria looked longingly at a fertility charm, at a magician's booth, Danny took that too and gave it to the handmaiden, thinking that now she should find something for Iri and Jiqui as well. Turning a corner, they came upon a wine merchant, offering thimble-sized cups of his wares to the passers-by.
Sweet reds! He cried in fluent Dothraki. I have sweet reds from Lys and Volantis and the Arbor. Whites from Lys, Tyroshi pear brandy, fire wine, pepper wine, the pale green nectars of myrrh, smokeberry browns and Andalish sours. I have them, I have them.
He was a small man, slender and handsome. His flaxen hair curled and perfumed after the fashion of Lys. When Danny paused before his stall, he bowed low.
A taste for the Khaleesi. I have a sweet red from Dawn, my lady. It sings of plums and cherries and rich dark oak. A cask, a cup, a swallow. One taste, and you will name your child after me.
Danny smiled. My son has his name. But I will try your summer wine, she said in Valyrian. Valyrian as they spoke it in the Free Cities. The words felt strange on her tongue after so long. Just a taste, if you'll be so kind. The merchant must have taken her for Dothraki, with her clothes and her oiled hair and sun-browned skin. When she spoke, he gaped at her in astonishment.
My lady, you are Tyroshi? Can it be so?
My speech may be Tyroshi, and my garb Dothraki, but I am of Westeros of the Sunset Kingdoms, Danny told him. Doria stepped up beside her. You have the honour to address Daenerys of the House Targaryen. Daenerys Stormborn, Khaleesi of the Riding Men and Princess of the Seven Kingdoms. The wine merchant dropped to his knees.
Princess, he said, bowing his head.
"Rise," Danny commanded him. "I would still like to taste that summer wine you spoke of." The man bounded to his feet. "That Dornish swill, it is not worthy of a princess. I have a dry red from the arbour, crisp and delectable. Please, let me give you a cask." Khal Drogo's visits to the Free Cities had given him a taste for good wine, and Danny knew that such a noble vintage would please him. "You honour me, sir," she murmured sweetly.
"The honour is mine."
The merchant rummaged about in the back of his stall and produced a small oaken cask. Burned into the wood was a cluster of grapes. "The red wine sigil," he said, pointing, "for the arbour. There is no finer drink." "Khal Drogo and I will share it together. Ego, take this back to my litter, if you'll be so kind." The wine seller beamed as the Dothraki hefted the cask. She did not realize that Ser Jorah had returned until she heard the knight say, "No!" His voice was strange, brusque. "Ego, put down that cask." Ego looked at Danny. She gave a hesitant nod. "Ser Jorah, is something wrong?"
"I have a thirst. Open it, wine cellar."
The merchant frowned.
"The wine is for the Khaleesi, not for the likes of you, sir."
Ser Jorah moved closer to the stall.
"If you don't open it, I'll crack it open with your head."
He carried no weapons here, in the sacred city, save his hands. Yet his hands were enough, big, hard, dangerous, his knuckles covered with coarse, dark hairs. The wine seller hesitated a moment, then took up his hammer and knocked the plug from the cask.
"Pour,"
Ser Jorah commanded. The four young warriors of Danny's cars arrayed themselves behind him, frowning, watching with their dark, almond-shaped eyes.
"It would be a crime to drink this richer wine without letting it breathe."
The wine seller had not put his hammer down. Jogo reached for the whip, coiled at his belt, but Danny stopped him, with a light touch on the arm. "Do as Ser Jorah says," she said. People were stopping to watch. The man gave her a quick, sullen look.
"As the princess commands."
He had to set aside his hammer to lift the cask. He filled two thimble-sized tasting cups, pouring so deftly he did not spill a drop. Ser Jorah lifted a cup and sniffed at the wine, frowning.
"Sweet, isn't it?" the wine seller said, smiling. "Can you smell the fruit, sir? The perfume of the arbour? Taste it, my lord, and tell me it isn't the finest, richest wine that's ever touched your tongue."
Ser Jorah offered him the cup.
"You taste it first."
"Me?"
the man laughed. "I'm not worthy of this vintage, my lord, and it's a poor wine merchant who drinks up his own wares." His smile was amiable, yet she could see the sheen of sweat on his brow.
"You will drink," Danny said, cold as ice. "Empty the cup, or I will tell them to hold you down while Ser Jorah pours a whole cask down your throat."
The wine seller shrugged, reached for the cup, and grabbed the cask instead, flinging it at her with both hands. Ser Jorah bawled into her, knocking her out of the way. The cask bounced off his shoulder and smashed open on the ground. Danny stumbled and lost her feet.
"No," she screamed, thrusting her hand out to break her fall,
and Daria caught her by the arm and wrenched her backwards, so she landed on her legs and not her belly. The trader vaulted over the stall, darting between Ego and Rakharo. Quaro reached for an arak that was not there, as the blond man slammed him aside. He raced down the aisle. Danny heard the snap of Jogo's whip, saw the leather lick out and coil around the wine seller's leg. The man sprawled face first in the dirt. A dozen caravan guards had come running. With them was the master himself, merchant captain Bayam Vatiris, a diminutive Norvashi, with skin like old leather and a bristling blue mustachio that swept up to his ears. He seemed to know what had happened without a word being spoken.
"Take this one away to await the pleasure of the Khal," he commanded, gesturing at the man on the ground.
Two guards haul the wine seller to his feet. His goods I gift to you as well, princess, the merchant captain went on. Small token of regret that one of mine would do this thing. Doria and Jiqui helped Danny back to her feet. The poison wine was leaking from the broken cask into the dirt. How did you know? She asked Ser Jorah, trembling. How?
I did not know, Khaleesi. Not until the man refused to drink. But once I read Magister Illyria's letter, I feared.
His dark eyes swept over the faces of the strangers in the market.
Come, best not to talk of it here.
Danny was near tears as they carried her back. The taste in her mouth was one she had known before. Fear. For years, she had lived in terror of Viserys, afraid of waking the dragon. This was even worse. It was not just for herself that she feared now, but for her baby. He must have sensed her fright, for he moved restlessly inside her. Danny stroked the swell of her belly gently, wishing she could reach him, touch him, soothe him. "You are the blood of the dragon, little one," she whispered, as her litter swayed along, curtains drawn tight. "You are the blood of the dragon, and the dragon does not fear." Under the hollow hummock of earth that was her home in Vaes Dothrak, Danny ordered them to leave her, all but Ser Jorah. "Tell me," she commanded, as she lowered herself onto her cushions, "was it the usurper?"
"Yes," the knight drew out a folded parchment. "A letter to Viserys from Magister Illyrio. Robert Baratheon offers lands and lordships for your death or your brother's."
"My brother?"
Her sob was half a laugh.
"He does not know yet, does he?"
"The usurper owes Drogo a lordship." This time, her laugh was half a sob. She hugged herself protectively. "And me, you said? Only me?"
"You and the child," Ser Jorah said, grim.
"No, he cannot have my son." She would not weep, she decided. She would not shiver with fear. "The usurper has woken the dragon now," she told herself, and her eyes went to the dragon's eggs resting in their nest of dark velvet. The shifting lamplight limned their stony scales, and shimmering motes of jade and scarlet and gold swam in the air around them, like courtiers around a king. Was it madness that seized her then, born of fear? Or some strange wisdom buried in her blood? Danny could not have said. She heard her own voice saying, "Ser Jorah, light the brazier."
"Khaleesi?"
The knight looked at her strangely.
"It is so hot. Are you certain?"
She had never been so certain. "Yes, I have a chill. Light the brazier." He bowed.
"As you command."
When the coals were afire, Danny sent Ser Jorah from her. She had to be alone to do what she must do. "This is madness," she told herself, as she lifted the black and scarlet egg from the velvet. "It will only crack and burn, and it's so beautiful. Ser Jorah will call me a fool if I ruin it. And yet, cradling the egg with both hands, she carried it to the fire and pushed it down amongst the burning coals. The black scales seemed to glow as they drank the heat. Flames licked against the stone with small red tongues. Danny placed the other two eggs beside the black one in the fire. As she stepped back from the brazier, the breath trembled in her throat. She watched until the coals had turned to ashes. Drifting sparks floated up and out of the smoke hole. Heat shimmered in waves around the dragon's eggs. And that was all.
"Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon," Ser Jorah had said.
Danny gazed at her egg sadly. What had she expected? 1,000,000 years ago, they had been alive, but now they were only pretty rocks. They could not make a dragon. A dragon was air and fire, living flesh, not dead stone. The brazier was cold again by the time Khal Drogo returned. Koholo was leading a pack horse behind him, with the carcass of a great white lion slung across its back. Above, the stars were coming out. The Khal laughed as he swung down off his stallion and showed her the scars on his legs where the Racha had raked him through his leggings.
"I shall make you a cloak of his skin, moon of my life," he swore.
When Danny told him what had happened at the market, all laughter stopped, and Khal Drogo grew very quiet.
"This poisoner was the first," Sir Jorah Mormont warned him, "but he will not be the last. Men will risk much for a lordship."
Drogo was silent for a time. Finally he said,
"This seller of poisons ran from the moon of my life. Better he should run after her. So he will. Jorgal, Jorah the Andal, to each of you I say, choose any horse you wish from my herds, and it is yours. Any horse save my red and the silver that was my bride gift to the moon of my life. I make this gift to you for what you did. And to Rego, son of Drogo, the stallion who will mount the world, to him I also pledge a gift. To him I will give this iron chair his mother's father sat in. I will give him 7 kingdoms. I, Drogo Khal, will do this thing."
His voice rose, and he lifted his fist to the sky.
"I will take my Khalasar west to where the world ends and ride the wooden horses across the black salt sea as no Khal has done before. I will kill the men in the iron suits and tear down their stone houses. I will rape their women, take their children as slaves, and bring their broken gods back to Vaes Dethrach to bow down beneath the mother of mountains. This I vow, I, Drogo, son of Barbo, this I swear before the mother of mountains, as the stars look down in witness."
His Khalasar left Vaes Dothrak 2 days later, striking south and west across the plains. Khal Drogo led them on his great red stallion, with Daenerys beside him on her silver. The wine seller hurried behind them, naked, on foot, chained at throat and wrist. His chains were fastened to the halter of Danny's silver. As she rode, he ran after her, barefoot and stumbling. No harm would come to him, so long as he kept up. Davos. For a moment it seemed as though the king had not heard. Stannis showed no pleasure at the news, no anger, no disbelief, not even relief. He stared at his painted table with teeth clenched hard. "You are certain?" he asked.
"I am not seeing the body, no, your kingliness," said Salladhor Saan. "Yet in the city, the lions prance and dance. The Red Wedding, the small folk are calling it. They swear Lord Frey had the boy's head hacked off, sewed the head of his direwolf in its place, and nailed a crown about his ears. His lady mother was slain as well, and thrown naked in the river."
"At a wedding," thought Davos, "as he sat at his slayer's board, a guest beneath his roof. These Freys are cursed."
He could smell the burning blood again, and hear the leech hissing and spitting on the brazier's hot coals.
"It was the Lord's wrath that slew him,"
Sir Axel Florent declared.
It was the hand of Renoir. Praise the Lord of Light, sang out Queen Celice, a pinched, thin, hard woman with large ears and a hairy upper lip.
Is the hand of Renoir spotted and palsied? Asked Stannis. This sounds more Waldo Frey's handiwork than any god's.
Renoir chooses such instruments as he requires. The ruby at Melisande's throat shone redly. His ways are mysterious, yet no man may withstand his fiery will.
No man can withstand him, the queen cried.
Be quiet, woman. You're not at a night fire now.
Stannis considered the painted table.
The wolf leaves no heirs. The kraken too many. The lions will devour them unless...
Son, I will require your fastest ships to carry envoys to the Iron Islands and White Harbour. I shall offer... pardons. The way he snapped his teeth showed how little he liked that word. Full pardons for all those who repent of treason and swear fealty to their rightful king. They must see...
They will not. Melisande's voice was soft. I'm sorry, Your Grace. This is not an end. More false kings will soon rise to take up the crowns of those who've died.
More? Stannis looked as though he would gladly have throttled her. More usurpers? More traitors?
I have seen it in the flames.
Queen Celice went to the king's side.
The Lord of Light sent Melisande to guide you to your glory. Heed her, I beg you. Relor's holy flames do not lie.
There are lies and lies, woman. Even when the flames speak truly, they are full of tricks, it seems to me.
An ant who hears the words of a king may not comprehend what he is saying, Melisande said, and all men are ants before the fiery face of God. If sometimes I have mistaken a warning for a prophecy, or a prophecy for a warning, the fault lies in the reader, not the book. But this I know for a certainty. Envoys and pardons will not serve you now, no more than leeches. You must show the realm a sign that proves your power.
Power? The king snorted. I have 1,300 men on Dragonstone, another 300 at Storm's End. His hand swept over the painted table. The rest of Westeros is in the hands of my foes. I have no fleet but Salador Sands, no coin to hire sellswords, no prospect of plunder or glory to lure free riders to my cause.
Lord Husband, said Queen Celice, you have more men than Aegon did 300 years ago. All you lack are dragons.
The look Stannis gave her was dark. 9 mages crossed the sea to hatch Aegon the Third's cache of eggs. Baelor the Blessed prayed over his for half a year. Aegon the Fourth built dragons of wood and iron. Arian Brightflame drank wildfire to transform himself. The mages failed. King Baelor's prayers went unanswered. The wooden dragons burned, and Prince Arian died screaming.
Queen Celice was adamant.
None of these was the chosen of Relor. No red comet blazed across the heavens to herald their coming. None wielded Lightbringer, the Red Sword of Heroes, and none of them paid the price. Lady Melisande will tell you, my lord, only death can pay for life.
The boy!
The king almost spat the words.
The boy,
agreed the queen.
The boy,
Sir Axel echoed. I was sick unto death of this wretched boy before he was even born, the king complained. His very name is a roaring in my ears and a dark cloud upon my soul.
Give the boy to me, and you need never hear his name spoken again,
Melisande promised.
No, but you'll hear him screaming when she burns him.
Davos held his tongue. It was wiser not to speak until the king commanded it.
Give me the boy for Relor, the Red Woman said, and the ancient prophecy shall be fulfilled. Your dragon shall awaken and spread his stony wings. The kingdom shall be yours.
Sir Axel went to one knee.
On bended knee, I beg you, sire, wake the stone dragon and let the traitors tremble. Like Aegon, you begin as Lord of Dragonstone. Like Aegon, ye shall conquer. Let the false and the fickle feel your flames.
Your own wife begs as well, Lord Husband.
Queen Selyse went down on both knees before the king, hands clasped as if in prayer.
Robert and Delina defiled our bed and laid a curse upon our union. This boy is the foul fruit of their fornications. Lift his shadow from my womb, and I will bear you many true-born sons, I know it.
She threw her arms around his legs.
He is only one boy born of your brother's lust and my cousin's shame.
He is mine own blood. Stop clutching me, woman. King Stannis put a hand on her shoulder, awkwardly untangling himself from her grasp. Perhaps Robert did curse our marriage bed. He swore to me that he never meant to shame me, that he was drunk, and never knew which bedchamber he entered that night. But does it matter? The boy was not at fault, whatever the truth. Melisande put a hand on the king's arm.
The Lord of Light cherishes the innocent. There's no sacrifice more precious. From his king's blood and his untainted fire, a dragon shall be born.
Stannis did not pull away from Melisande's touch as he had from his queen's. The Red Woman was all Selyse was not, young, full-bodied, and strangely beautiful, with her heart-shaped face, coppery hair, and unearthly red eyes.
It would be a wondrous thing to see stone come to life, he admitted grudgingly, and to mount a dragon. I remember the first time my father took me to court. Robert had to hold my hand. I could not have been older than 4, which would have made him 5 or 6. We agreed afterward that the king had been as noble as the dragons were fearsome.
Stannis snorted.
Years later, our father told us that Aerys had cut himself on the throne that morning, so his hand had taken his place. It was Tywin Lannister who'd so impressed us.
His fingers touched the surface of the table, tracing a path lightly across the varnished hills. Robert took the skulls down when he'd donned the crown, but he could not bear to have them destroyed. Dragon wings over Westeros. There would be such a...
Your Grace, Davos edged forward, might I speak?
Stannis closed his mouth so hard his teeth snapped.
My Lord of the Rainwood, why do you think I made your hand, if not to speak?
The king waved a hand. Say what you will.
Warrior, make me brave.
I know little of dragons and less of gods, but the queen spoke of curses. No man is as cursed as a kinslayer in the eyes of gods and men.
There are no gods save R'hllor, and the other whose name must not be spoken.
Melisande's mouth made a hard red line.
And small men curse what they cannot understand.
I am a small man, Davos admitted. So tell me why you need this boy, Edric Storm, to wait your great stone dragon, my lady.
He was determined to say the boy's name as often as he could.
Only death can pay for life, my lord. A great gift requires a great sacrifice.
Where is the greatness in a base-born child?
He has king's blood in his veins. You have seen what even a little of that blood could do.
I saw you burn some leeches.
And 2 false kings are dead.
Robb Stark was murdered by Lord Walder of the Crossing, and we have heard that Balon Greyjoy fell from a bridge. Who did your leeches kill?
Do you doubt the power of R'hllor? No.
Davos remembered too well the living shadow that had squirmed from out of her womb, that night beneath Storm's End, its black hands pressing at her thighs.
I must go carefully here, or some shadow may come seeking me as well. Even an onion smuggler knows 2 onions from 3. You are short a king, my lady.
Stannis gave a snort of laughter.
He has you there, my lady. 2 is not 3.
To be sure, your grace, 1 king might die by chance, even 2. But 3? If Joffrey should die in the midst of all his power, surrounded by his armies and king's guard, would not that show the power of the Lord at work?
It might.
The king spoke as if he grudged every word.
Or not.
Davos did his best to hide his fear.
"Joffrey shall die,"
Queen Selyse declared, serene in her confidence.
"It may be that he's dead already."